Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
This place is special.
Get asked all the time, where's your favorite place to take College Game Day? And I say every time, Eugene, Oregon.
Yeah.
This is the best crowd. Honestly, it's 6 in the morning here.
Yeah.
It's dark. Yeah. It's raining. They don't care.
No, they don't.
These fans right here, pound for pound, are as good as any college football fans in the country.
This program is staged to compete and to win championships.
Oregon is going to be in the championship game. Can you believe the magical season this has become?
When we watch this film, does our effort beat theirs?
Here's Bo Nix. Guns it! Touchdown, Oregon!
Been making deposits. Time to cash a check.
Sound at Austin, which is deafening for an Oregon 15-point win. Chip Kelly still does not have a win against his former school, and we say farewell.
Man, it feels great to be a Duck.
Welcome to the QB11 Show, presented by Scoop Duck, with Doug, Andrew, and J-Hop. Here are the guys with the latest scoop.
Hello and welcome back to the QB11 Show, presented by Scoop Duck. As always, I'm Doug Scott and joined by QB11 himself, Andrew. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Doug. It's good to be back. I know it's been a little bit longer than planned, but excited to be back talking about some Oregon football because it's weird. Usually this time of year, I'm kind of like not all that. Like I'm plugged in. I'm seeing, watching what's happening, but I'm like unbelievably excited about this team and this program right now. I don't know I've ever been more confident during an off season about what this program is, where it's going, what this team is and where it's going. Just given some of the factors at play, like there's usually a lot of projection involved. It's like, hey, we're going to be probably a top 15 team next year is like my expectation most years. And if certain guys can take big jumps or take jumps that we expect, then this team has a shot to be pretty good. But this team is like, I know we have dogs all over the place, and I know we've got a really good staff and a lot of good staff continuity, and we've got depth everywhere and unbelievable recruiting classes and transfer portal classes coming in, and it's weird. It's a different feeling than I'm used to.
Yeah, and we talked a lot about the roster management a couple episodes ago and how elite that has been for Oregon. And just, you know, we've talked a lot about the blue chips, right? There was 52 on the roster last year. We're up to 64 right now with potentially some more being added, maybe some more being dropped. But, you know, to go up, like that's rarefied air, right? Like as we go into next year and you look at when August rolls around and the 247 releases their updated team talent composite, once all the rosters are set, like Oregon's going to be at worst the sixth most talented roster in the country. Now, that's paper talent, it's recruiting rankings talent, you know, all the caveats involved with that. But still, to think that they're going to be somewhere between fourth and sixth is just insane.
Yeah.
So it just shows you how much leveled up the roster building and talent acquisition and retention. I think that's the thing that's lost. Like everyone talks about the recruiting and like all the guys we're bringing in, and Oregon brought in like 22 blue chips in this class alone, which is insane. But keeping the talent is also something you see around the country. We're going to talk about this later in the episode. You see around the country programs, even really good programs, you know, at times are struggling to keep high level talent on their rosters. And that is something where Oregon has done just as good of a job as keeping their talent as they had of going out and getting more talent.
Yeah, the acquisition's good. The retention's even better. Has Oregon lost a single player this offseason that we anticipated would have played a role, like a big role? I'm trying to think off the top of my head. No one obvious is coming to mind.
No, I don't. I can't think of any off the top of my head either that we would have expected to play any kind of significant role at all. I mean, you know, there's people that, Cole Martin, you know, he played in every game last year. Okay, but he was a special teams player for the most part, spot duty at safety. I don't anticipate that he would have had much of a bigger role, if any, you know, in this coming season either. That's not something I consider a. No disrespect to Cole Martin, right? But that's not something I consider like, oh no, a significant loss, right? It's like, okay, you know, we lost a role player who's probably going to be replaced by someone who's just as good, if not better.
Well, yeah, especially when you consider what's coming in the portal, like when you weigh that loss on like a scale of like what you lost versus what you added. And then when you also factor for prep guys incoming, it's not particularly close, right? So that's not. Again, he's a solid player, but he's at Arizona State for a reason, right? Like, it's not like he's transferred to Michigan or Ohio State or USC or another big program that would pose any kind of threat to Oregon. He's basically transferring down a level.
So before we jump into the rest of it, we got some more questions, our listener questions segment that kind of talk a little bit more about the roster, and we'll get back into that in some more depth, QB. And before we jump in too far here, I do want to apologize for our listeners. I know last episode we teased the fact that we're going to be back with Justin on this next one, and that it was going to come out a couple of days ago. And I just want to apologize to everyone due to some technical difficulties, primarily on my end. That did not work out. We actually all three got together and tried to record, and we had some pretty significant hiccups. We've worked past those. We have a time set for next week, so the three of us should be on together next Monday, and we'll get that episode out to you all. And I know everyone's looking forward to that, and obviously you and I are as well. So I just want to apologize for that delay, but it is still coming. We haven't led you astray there.
Yeah, and I know, like, what we also want to make sure is that we're putting out a good product, right? And so, like, we were having some technical difficulties. We might have been able to force something out, but it wouldn't have matched the quality that I think our listener would be accustomed to.
All right, QB, let's dive in. From a roster standpoint and a recruiting standpoint for the 2024 cycle, I mean, obviously the spring portal, we don't know what that'll bring, you know, both in terms of outgoing transfers, as well as if there's a couple of targets that might hit the market that Oregon might be interested in then. But what we do know for now, you have the February signing day, this, you know, what used to be the traditional high school signing day, now is the second signing day in February. And really the only target that Oregon's pursuing still from the high school ranks is Gatlin Bear, the wide receiver out of Idaho, what, top 50 player in the country right now, one of the top rated wide receivers in the country. And he had previously committed to Boise State, decommitted quite some time ago, and it's really been a Michigan versus Oregon battle for his services. And, you know, it certainly would seem that with Jim Harbaugh, who we're going to talk about soon, moving on to the NFL, like, Oregon's got to be in the catbird seat now, right?
Yeah, I mean, who knows? I mean, so there's a couple assumptions that have to be made there. I think the first one would be is that the kid didn't have at least somewhat of an indication that that was a possibility. Now, whether or not that was a possibility that he was aware of and was still going to have an impact on his decision, I mean, only him and his family know that answer. But I think that it certainly can't hurt, right? Because it's not going to be just Jim Harbaugh that leaves. It'll at least be him, Jesse Minter, and Jay Harbaugh, the defensive coordinator and the special teams coordinator. And I don't think that any of those guys are going to have massive impacts on his recruitment, but I think that the loss of those guys might have impact on the perception of the strength of that coaching staff going forward. And so, like, when you look at those two, Oregon and Michigan side by side right now going into next year, who do you think is actually the program? And really, it's beyond next year, right? Because Gatlin Bear's not going to arrive on campus wherever he signs for another 2 years. So he's really a 2026 signee. And so what program has better stability for him going forward? I think there's a very strong case to be made on for Oregon's behalf in that, because with Dan's commitment, passing on the Bama job, and some of the other things going on in the program right now, just how strong the roster looks. Like, that Michigan team seems to have, obviously they won a national title, and that's never a bad thing. But like, when you're projecting forward, who do you think has better odds of getting back to that place or repeating that level of success, given Jim Harbaugh's loss? I think that Oregon has a lot to sell on that. So, and then also from an offensive like fit standpoint, like which offense would you rather play in? Because
Would you rather put up 45 points a game and throw the ball around, or ground and pound?
Yeah, that really is the math. Like, it sounds kind of basic and like troll to say it like that, but that's kind of the difference between these two teams in terms of philosophy. And so I think he's going to ultimately end up picking the team that's going to showcase his talent better and give him more opportunities to show off his explosive athleticism. And I think that's Oregon. So I agree with you, but I don't think it's quite that cut and dry. Like, I think especially with his teammate Colson Loveland, his high school teammate playing playing tight end for Michigan, I think it's still going to be difficult to get a commitment from Bear, just given some of the other factors at play with the families and the familiarity with some of the players from the team out there.
Well, that's something to watch as we close in on that second signing day here in a couple of weeks. Shifting over on the transfer side, Oregon's taken 10 transfers so far this cycle, which I think was a little bit more than I was expecting. But, you know, there was obviously some things that they knew about what they needed and wanted that I probably didn't anticipate. And they've taken 3 defensive backs in this cycle. But, you know, Jabbar Muhammad is coming to campus this week, played for Washington last year, obviously getting all the way to that national title game. He has visited Texas and Alabama previously last week. He's coming to Oregon. This will be his last visit, and then he's going to make a decision from that point. And obviously, he's been leaked with Oregon, and there's a lot of crystal balls and whatnot. I know Justin put a prediction in on Scoop Duck for him earlier this week as well. You know, is Jabbar Muhammad someone like they see as like, we absolutely need a corner, or it's just he's too good to pass up, or probably some of both?
Well, I tweeted earlier this week that there was a knee surgery for Jaleel Florence, and like, I didn't know at that time what the severity of that injury was, what the timeline for a possible return looked like. And I've been told since then that it sounds like it was a pretty minor knee procedure. It's not like an ACL or anything like that, and he won't be gone for that long. So with that in mind, I think this is really just a matter of like, he's such a good player that they want to have him. I do think he offers more scheme versatility than he might have shown at Washington. Should we just talk about him as if he's a commitment, just to like talk about him as a player? And why that seems
I mean, we talk about where he would fit in, you know, where he would fit, assuming he does commit to Oregon, where he would fit in the defense and how he would be used.
So I think he'd be a starting outside corner, but I also would not be surprised at all to see him play inside in the nickel, specifically to like if Jaleel Florence is healthy and Cam Alexander comes in and plays up to the standard that he played at UTSA, you would think that you have 3 starter caliber corners at a minimum. And that's excluding guys like Dante Manning. That's excluding guys like Roger Pleasant, Ifeo Badegwu, Sione Lalea, and Dakota Fields. I'm counting Dalen Austin as part of the nickel room. And so what I think this would allow is Oregon to, against certain teams, like against an Ohio State, to get into that 3 safety package or that 3 corner package, or maybe even go to some dime stuff where they're playing 6 defensive backs and be able to match up a lot better. Because one of the things about Muhammad game is he's really twitchy and quick in the short area. And he does a great job of matching those short routes and being able to close and actually make breaks on those balls, as opposed to just stopping them from short games. Like, he can actually stop the completion from occurring. So, I think he'll be awesome on the outside. I think he would be excellent on the inside, situationally. And I think he's a guy that's just going to be on the field a lot because he's always around the ball. He had 20 pass breakups, 3 interceptions last year. And he's a guy that's trying to earn some money for the NFL draft the following season. So, this would be a really big pickup. He's a starter caliber player. And it's interesting because we look at, like, I think the top 2 defensive backs on Oregon's group from last year combined for like 12 pass breakups. Alexander, I could be off by 1 or 2 here, had like 17 last year, and Muhammad had 20. And so they're getting guys who are better ball athletes, in my opinion, who are around the ball more frequently and able to make plays on the ball and disrupt passes and not just prevent explosives, but prevent anything at all.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So, yeah, we'll see. I think in keeping on that, he's visiting Oregon this weekend. Presumably there'll be a decision made, you know, early to mid next week. And, you know, whether that's Oregon or Texas or Alabama, it certainly seems like it's trending in the back in the direction of Oregon. It seemed like it was Oregon early when the portal first opened, and then seemed like the winds were blowing towards Texas and then kind of back toward Bama. He went to see his old coach DeBoer there, but now it seems like it's trending back toward Oregon. So, you know, hopefully this is another one the good guys can lock down and add to that. You know, this will be the fourth defensive back they've gotten out of the portal. So clearly they saw, you know, the desire or need to remake that room. And we have a question about that later, so I'll hold on further conversation there. Maybe we'll get to that in the question section. But, yeah, good recap on Jabbar. The big news this week, obviously, Jim Harbaugh leaving Michigan to take the head coaching job of the L.A. Chargers now. I keep calling them San Diego, which is big news from an Oregon perspective for those of you who are Justin Herbert fans and Charger fans by extension then. So Herbert now will have Jim Harbaugh as his coach. This will be his third NFL coach in, what, five seasons? And obviously he had three head coaches at Oregon as well. So coaching stability, unfortunately, has been something that Justin Herbert has not had the luxury of at any point in his college or pro career. And, you know, Harbaugh, I would have to imagine you would agree, is the best coach he's probably ever had.
Oh, yeah, not even close. And my question is who he'll bring in as the offensive coordinator, because I've heard Greg Roman rumored, and I don't know that that's a great fit for him, because for all the things I think Harbaugh is excellent at the head coach, I don't know that he's the best quarterback guy. And so I just hope that he picks an offensive coordinator that suits Justin's skill set instead of just leaning into what he does really well, or what he likes to do, I should say, what his preferences. But I'm far from an expert on the situation in Los Angeles. And I'm not a Chargers fan per se, but I want to see Justin Herbert be successful and play well. So, hoping that Harbaugh can have similar success to what he had in San Fran and in Michigan, and Justin Herbert can play for some good teams that are competing for Super Bowls over the next couple of years.
Absolutely. Going back to the college side of this, you know, certainly we saw a lot of chaos. We're going to talk about that next with Alabama and certainly Washington and Arizona, you know, to different degrees when their head coaches left. And that opens up this 30-day portal window, right? So yeah, for those of you who aren't aware, the transfer portal basically ran for the entire month of December. It closed down in early January, right after New Year's, except there's a provision that says if your head coach leaves, then there's a 30-day window for the transfer portal reopens for players at that school. So, you know, in Michigan's case, we haven't seen anyone that I'm aware of enter the portal yet since Harbaugh's announcement. And I think the prevailing wisdom seems to be they probably aren't going to suffer some of the same fate that those other schools have, especially if they just promote Sharon Moore to be the new head coach and kind of keep a continuity play going, much like, you know, Oregon did when they hired Mario, you know, when Taggart left, right, trying to keep the game together again. And I assume you agree that's probably the hire they're going to make and that we would anticipate a lot of attrition on their roster because of it.
Oh, I would be surprised if anyone left, like anyone that wasn't already leaving. Right. And, they had some guys transfer out, I think, after the Natty. But they also were such a senior laden team that I don't know that they have a lot of processing to do, just given the fact that I think they're probably going to lose like 35 guys off last year's roster just organically. And really, like, I think that, like Harbaugh did such a good job there, and Moore's been his right hand man, and Moore was the head coach for four games this season, and it seems like it's a very much so, like you had mentioned, a continuation of passing of the torch. And so I don't think we're going to see any poaching off the Michigan roster, at least not a guys that they want to keep. I think that, like, if anyone leaves, it's because they're clearing space, but this is not an Alabama or Washington situation, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think I agree. Let's move on to that. So we talked about this on you and I talked about this on our last episode, QB. Unfortunately, this is the segment of that episode that got lost to history, and none of our listeners got to hear us talk about Washington and Arizona and Alabama. So I guess we're going to try to recreate as best we can that conversation We'll see where that goes. But obviously, Saban retires. A couple things happen. Within, 48 to 72 hours, Alabama had hired Kalen DeBoer to be their new head coach. And within that same time frame and afterwards, Alabama lost a number of recruits in the 2025 cycle as well, or commits in the 2025 cycle, as well as, they had a number of transfer portal exits. And some of those would have happened anyway, right? Normal attrition and, roster spots and where you're out on the depth chart. But certainly guys like Caleb Downs, hitting the portal, or Caden Proctor and some of the other higher profile transfers that happened were certainly a product of the coaching change itself. It certainly seems to have slowed down now. They've managed to stop the bleeding a little bit there. They've actually backfilled some of those positions. But, talk about Alabama. Like, what do you – I think there's two ways to phrase this. I think, first of all, let's all say, Alabama is not going to repeat what they did under Nick Saban, right? And I don't think any team would. And I don't even think even if Nick Saban stayed – the last 15 years, he won, we won six titles in 10 years or six titles in 12 years. Like, nobody's going to do that in the 12-team playoff era, even Nick Saban. So they were not likely to have the same level of success, even had Nick stayed. What do you see as Alabama's outlook for next season, let's say, but then even, over, the 3 to 5 year horizon, where do you put them in the pecking order nationally and in the SEC, do you think?
It's really
maybe too early to say, but yeah, I'm going to put you on the spot.
It's really going to depend on how DeBoer recruits, right? Like, if he can keep that roster at anything approaching the level that it was at, or even 80% of that, then I think that they're still a contender in that league. And I think it's really, it's tough because the top of that league is so competitive. There's so many big time programs. Like, you have LSU and Texas and Tennessee and Georgia and Florida and Ole Miss is spending money, and Missouri is good right now. So there's a lot of quality in that league.
And you didn't even mention Oklahoma either.
Yeah. And I didn't even mention Oklahoma, didn't mention Auburn. And so we're so used to Bama just being a fixture at the top of the SEC. And I think that Kalen DeBoer is a good enough coach to keep them there, to be honest with you. I just don't know what it's going to look like from a talent acquisition standpoint, because they lost some pretty important dudes here over the last week since the portal opened for their guys, I should say, and all of this transfer activity kind of got off the ground. And so I don't have a real definitive answer, to be honest, but I tend to think they're going to take a step back, and I think that Georgia is going to be the dominant program in that league. And to be fair, that's kind of already been happening, even with Saban there. But we saw Alabama fight back today. They got Ryan Williams, the five-star receiver from Alabama, recommitted. That's a huge one. He's a super high-end talent, and I think that when you get a guy like that to pair with Austin Mack as the future of your quarterback room, then you're that's a good foundation to start with. And I do think that they're going to be able to recruit at a much higher level than they did at Washington, because I think the resources are much better and the brand is much better. And Alabama isn't going to have the cachet that it had with Saban clicking at full tilt. No. But is it going to have still really strong pull with players? Absolutely. In my opinion. So we'll see what happens, but I think Alabama's probably going to settle into that 3 to 5 range in the SEC, and on a given year, they can hop up and challenge for a title.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And DeBoer did go out to Washington, as you mentioned, and pick up probably his three best young players on that roster, right? Austin Mack, he was a true freshman this year, early, basically reclassified, so really should have been a high school senior this past season. At quarterback, as you mentioned, Parker Brailsford, the starting center from Washington last year, he was a redshirt freshman, and then Jeremy Bernard, the young wide receiver. So all three of those are joining him in Washington, from Washington into Alabama. And I think he got what he wanted from that roster.
100%.
We're going to talk about next. I don't think there's anything left on Washington's roster that would be Alabama quality.
And he also got the one recruit on that on that commitment list that he probably would have wanted to.
Noah Carter.
Noah Carter committing today. And Dominic Kirk's ended up at Ohio State. So there's been some other movement from Washington signing class as well to other high-end programs.
Yeah, let's talk about that next, because this, a lot of people have likened, it's funny because I think when you people talk about Washington in regards to the 2024 season looking ahead, it's really easy to tell, have they been someone who's following what's happening at Washington, or are they someone who knows what Washington did this previous season? And because, you know, I listen to national podcasts as recently as today, and these people are talking about Washington as like one of the Big Ten contenders next season. And I'm sorry, you're just not up to speed on what the Washington roster situation looks like if you think that. But other people who obviously are following it more closely, Bud Elliott is a great example of this, right? And even he came out, I think earlier this week and kind of listed like an early like range of like rankings of every program, most of the major programs, and said, oh, at best, like Georgia's the first best team in the country, and at worst they're the third, right? And he kind of did a range for every team, and he started with Washington as 15 to 25. And like within not very long, he was kind of like, yeah, my bad there. Their lower end range needs to be much lower. And honestly, I think 15 is...
I think they're more like, I think on the high end is probably like 25 to, and then low end probably 50.
Yeah. Yeah. Kibi, let me just read some of this to you. Obviously most of their elite players last year were all moving on anyway to the NFL, whether they're out of eligibility or whether they declared early, right? They lost their top three quarterbacks, from their roster last year. They lost their number one running back, actually their top two running backs from last year's offense. They lost their top four wide receivers, three to the draft, one to Alabama, as you mentioned. They've lost their entire starting offensive line, and I think their top backup, so their top six offensive linemen. And then, on the defensive side of the ball, I think what they have two starters total back from their entire 22, none on offense, two on defense, and out of their two deep, I think it's down under 10 now that are returning this year. And someone likened it to getting the death penalty. Like you're basically starting all over. And honestly, it's not far off.
No, it seems that they're starting to get a couple of guys out of the portal from Arizona. They got Jonah Coleman. It seems that Ephesians Prysock will end up in that class. But we've also seen some guys that I think Washington was penciling in at Arizona, not just T-Mac and Fafita, but they also had Raymond Polito decide to stay. It sounds like Takerio Davis, the cornerback, is leaning toward staying from the reporting I saw today. And the other tackle, it's a Polynesian name that's escaping me currently.
Manu at linebacker.
Yeah, Manu's staying. So it seems that the core nucleus of that Arizona team is going to remain, with the exception of Jonah Coleman and Ephesians Prysock, which means that they're going to have to go down, like, because currently, like, the players that are in the portal have been picked through pretty good, right? And Washington's guys are getting picked through in a situation where all of their guys are available and every other team is just shopping and looking for pieces to add to make a run at a 12-team playoff next year. And there's no way that Jed Fish and this Washington staff are selling that to that team. So, like, we saw Nate Kalepo commit to Ole Miss today. It sounds like Julius Bulow will be following. Also, Asa Turner committed to Florida. We've seen a lot of guys that would have been kind of like the keystones of this Washington defense and offense commit to other schools here recently. So, and it's not like there's anything for Washington to pick through other than the Arizona roster, which seems to be staying put. And then I guess the trickle down effect now is the San Jose State and Weber State rosters. And I don't know how many guys off the San Jose State roster are going to be the type of players that Washington's going to want. And frankly, like, Brandon's going to have really good relationships with those guys, and Arizona's going to have more immediate success to sell going into next year. So it just puts Washington in a really tough spot, where they're he's having to turn water to wine. And he was able to get Will Rogers back in the boat, Davis, the incoming freshman quarterback, seems to be remaining along with the kid that he flipped from Arizona's class. I think his name is also David.
Damond Williams.
Damond Williams. I think they're having more success with guys that can see the vision longer term, but with portal guys right now, it's tough.
Yeah, because if you're in the portal, you're either, if you're a high-end player in the portal, you're looking to go to a high-end program, right? And all those guys, like you said, are picked over already. And as the spring portal window is coming up, you know, what do you see in the spring portal typically? You see guys who, I'm not in the two deep, I'm not in the rotation, I'm third on the depth chart, I'm fourth on the depth chart, I'm going to hit the portal and go find a new home, right? And so if that, like, Washington is at the point now where they just need quantity, right? They're at a Colorado situation where they just need bodies. But it's very different than, like, I need three guys to fill three spots, right? And you it's more like, I need 20 guys. They need 20 players this spring.
Yeah. And I don't know where you're going to find, like we talk about being above or below the line. Like, when you're having to recruit like that, what is the line?
Yeah, because what they really need is 20 starting caliber players.
And there's no way they're even going to get that.
That's not available.
No.
Right. The players are going to get are probably worse than the players already have, who really shouldn't be, most of them shouldn't be starters. I mean, look, they've got nice players here and there, right? Like, but you go through their roster, like Will Rogers, okay. You know, if he's your game manager quarterback and you have a, like, strong offensive line and a running game or whatever, okay, great. But now you're like, you're going to be behind most games and you're going to be relying on him to throw the ball around behind what offensive line, because they don't have, I mean, their offensive line is the Azapardi, the transfer from San Diego State at tackle. And then they've got guard Memelar, Sam Peacock, Jalen Clem, you know, Sione Fasolo, Zachary Henning, and Elijah Jackett. That's it. That's their entire offensive line roster. Nine players. Like, Oregon has 19 on the roster. You know, so you need to form a starting five and some key backups out of that. I mean, good luck. You know, move on. You know, they have six receivers total on the roster, right? And the best one they have is Giles Jackson. Like, Giles Jackson was a nice, third, fourth receiver?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if he's actually the best guy or if it's Boston, but regardless, regardless, when you compare it to what they had a year ago, it's quite the step back. And I think as I kind of comb through the roster that they've got and look at what they have coming back, like, the positions that I'm actually not, like, terribly low on them are kind of surprising. Like, edge, like, I liked a little bit I saw Jacob Lane. I liked a little bit I saw Lance Holtzclaw. And we'll see what Zach Durfee looks like with a full offseason, or if he ends up falling into Bama too. Not that I think he's a Bama quality player. I think that's probably a guy that ends up below the line there and stays at Washington. But, like, the interior of the defensive line, which already wasn't very good, is completely decimated. The offensive line outside of the San Diego State transfer and guard, who was I believe he was going to be the starting right guard going into the season and then got hurt in fall camp. At least that's what I was told.
Yeah, he was in the running there, guard Memelar. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. So I think that between those two guys, they've got, like, two, like, power five quality players. Is there a third on that roster right now? That's like, especially going into Big Ten, where, like, if they don't get this figured out, Will Rogers is going to have to get scraped off the field by a shovel after playing against Oregon, Penn State, and Michigan. Like, he's just going to get absolutely feasted on, because those teams all have really, really good pass rushes, and this offensive line looks like group of five level. And that, frankly, like, it probably wouldn't be a very good group of five offensive line right now.
Yeah, and you move over to the other side of the ball, you know, the interior, you got Jacob Bandez, you know, the Parker twins, and Elanius Davis are your interior defensive linemen. So you've got one guy who's played, 4 or 5 years now and has been below replacement level, I think, by your analysis, and Bandez, and the other three guys haven't even really seen the field.
Bandez.
On any meaningful amount.
Calling Bandez replacement level is very nice. That's very kind.
I said below replacement level.
oh, my bad. I misheard you. But yeah, I think that's fair. The other position where they're fine is probably running back, surprisingly, which is a position that they've not been good at for quite a long time, actually. And like getting Jonah Coleman out of the portal, I think is a really nice pickup for them. And then they have Cam Davis coming back from a season-ending knee injury that he suffered during fall camp last year. So that group to me actually looks kind of solid.
That's a solid top two. Yeah that's a good sure. top.
I would say that's good. Now, is it going to be like the best or one of the best in the Big Ten? Absolutely not, because the Big Ten's running back rooms are absolutely terrifying next year. But that's a group that you can build.
But that's a top two you can win with if you have the other pieces.
100%, without a doubt. But do they have the other pieces is the question.
Yeah, who's opening the holes for those running backs?
Well, what's going to stop teams to just stack the box? Because like as much as Will Rogers had success in that system that Leach ran way back in the day, like who's he throwing to? Where's the protection coming from? And like he was not productive in a non-air raid system. And while I know Jed Fish is a really smart offensive coach who will do what's best for his players and put them in positions to be successful, his system is not an air raid system. So there's a lot of questions to be asked there. And I'm intrigued to see how it all plays out.
Yeah, I mean, and you go on the defensive side of the ball, we talked about the line, you know, you mentioned the edges. You know, they've got a couple of quality linebackers. Carson Bruner, Afonso Tupitalo are fine. Beyond that, it's a bunch of unproven players, right? And then you go to the defensive backs, and I mean, the safety nickel rooms, oof. It's, I mean, Cam from Bikimon on is fine, and then it's just a bunch of dudes who've never played. It's rough. I mean, I don't know how this team stops anybody next year. I think they're giving up 40 a game.
Yeah, and I think they're going to constantly be playing behind and be in obvious passing situations, which is like Jed Fish is going to have to make a business decision. Am I going to put my quarterback in a position to get absolutely destroyed and killed, or am I just going to stay? I'm just going to play to keep games closer and run the ball still and just get out of there. And like it really depends. Like, are they going to play to win, or are they going to play to keep games close and try to recruit?
Yeah, or try to steal some game. I mean, I don't know what their NIL situation is. You know, you hear different stories from different people, but if I was running that program, like I would 2024, I'd just say it was lost, right? Like I wouldn't go out and buy any players who don't help me 2 years down the road, 3 years down the road. It's just a waste of funds, right? You're better off to hold it, you know, spend what you have to, if you're going to spend NIL money, spend it on a guy who's going to be here for 25 and 26 and beyond, right? Don't spend it on a 1 year player. That's just a waste. Like, take your lumps this year and recruit, well, like you said.
And the other thing is, like, what's the inventory of the portal going to be? The second portal window is never as active as the first, and typically, like, it's guys like the second portal is guys like getting processed out to make room for incoming freshmen that are enrolling in the summer. So like, how many quality players are really going to hit the portal in the second window? And then the second question is like, Washington is not going to have first round refusal on any of them, no matter how much money they offer, because there's a hell of a lot of schools with a lot better chance of winning something meaningful next year. So like, what is a reasonable expectation for one, the quantity, but two, the quality of player that they're going to be able to pull out of the second transfer portal window? I'm not optimistic on their behalf in that one.
Not at all. I didn't get to the corner room, but it's pretty dire as well. I mean, they've got Elijah Jackson, you know, had moments last year at corner opposite Jabbar. And then Devon Banks was a young player who looked good early in the season, I think the first two games before getting hurt and missing the rest of the season. But again, beyond that, it's a bunch of young, unproven guys. So, you know, when quarterbacks see, true freshman or redshirt freshman corners and safeties lined up, you know, five across, it's the eyes get real big, and like you said, even the best players at those positions usually take their lumps when they're young and they're playing for the first time.
Yep, 100%. And I don't know how this team keeps it on the rails. Like, it's going to be a test for the culture next year, because it could get ugly for them. I know I've talked to some Washington fans, and I'm not, like, as much fun as it is to poke and troll, like I don't want to be an asshole, because frankly, like, that could be us at any point. It was after Mario, right? But like, they're penciling in Rutgers and Northwestern as wins. And I'm like, I don't think that that's an automatic win. Like, I think people that don't watch Big Ten football don't realize that Rutgers is a pretty respectable program now.
Their defense was pretty solid last year.
And they return basically everyone, and their running back is really good, and they know who they are. Greg Schiano's done a really good job recruiting there. So it's like, I wouldn't count on that. And like, despite them losing their coach, Northwestern was like a plucky competitive team last year, and they are retaining their roster. Like, they're not getting picked through like Washington.
Yeah, they went to a bowl game. Yeah.
So,
I didn't even go back one step further. Washington State, like, can you pencil that in as a win? I mean, Washington State's got a lot more continuity in their roster and their schemes and everything too. And you know, they have a full roster at least. Now, I mean, I'm not saying Washington State's going to win, but I'll bet that, I mean, they made it a game last year, right? Why wouldn't that be a game again?
Well, they don't have Cam Ward, and they've lost some other important players, both to the draft and the portal. I don't know what the quarterback situation is at Washington State. I would favor this Washington team over that Washington State team. Probably pretty.
Yeah. I would too. I'm just saying, like, I don't think it's like an automatic win necessarily, right? Like, that's a rivalry game. It's a, you know, one team has a little bit more stability than the other. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
I you know, look, if I'm a Washington fan, thank God I'm not. I'd be happy to make a bowl game next year. And I think, you know, I see some that, oh yeah, you know, we'll get the roster figured out and we'll win 8-9. And I'm just like, I mean,
there's just no chance. Okay. There's just not enough. I look at their schedule right now. And that, to me, like, there's four like stone cold lock losses. And I kind of think there's a fifth with Iowa. So
who's your fourth after Oregon, Michigan, and Penn State?
Oh, USC.
USC. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Like, as much as I don't think USC is a contender for the conference, but USC is going to be a team that will score 70 points on this Washington secondary.
Yeah. So if you have those four, and then you've got, you know, games like UCLA, games like you said, at Iowa, at Rutgers, Northwestern, like, those are toss-up kind of games, right? Like, and you got to win half of those to get to a bowl.
Yeah, that doesn't seem likely. I wouldn't be surprised if they went 2-1 against Indiana, Northwestern, and Rutgers, but I don't think they're going to go 3-0. And like, I think 3-0 is kind of a necessity to get to a bowl game.
Yeah, if you figure Iowa's a loss, that's five losses. You got to beat with the Washington State game. You got to go 3-0 against those, and then you got it. And then UCLA kind of becomes one you could drop and still get in. Yeah
but like, I
think they're right in that.
I just don't know how good UCLA is going to be, because there's been like rumors about what Chip might be doing or not doing this offseason. Like, we'll see how that all plays out. But like, as it stands today, I would favor UCLA against Washington, especially
right now.
I think it is.
No, both the LA schools come to Husky Field this year.
Oh, got it.
Husky Stadium.
Perfect.
Yeah, so, you know, if it was any other school other than Washington, I would feel bad. But it's Washington, so I don't feel bad.
I don't feel bad at all. This is wonderful.
I'm enjoying this quite a lot. And look, it's really interesting because, you know, Alabama took Kalen DeBoer. Now, Alabama didn't want to go raid Washington's roster for obvious reasons. And then Jed Fish moves from Arizona to Washington, and he did want to raid his old roster. He also, which he did to some degree, but like you said, when he first went there, it was Fafita was going to go, T-Mac was going to go, like, Polito was going to go. It was going to be 15 players. It was going to be their best 15 players. They're maybe getting half of that, probably a little less than half.
I don't even think they're getting half. I think they're going to get like four, five.
Maybe five, yeah. So Arizona did and then beyond that, Washington also lost all their best players to other schools, right? Not even to Alabama, right? Those guys were just like, peace out, we're done, we're leaving, right? And so I think Arizona's done a much better job of retaining their roster with their coaching change, playing defense, and holding the fort down. And I thought they made some pretty good coaching hires as well for their situation.
Yeah. Well, Arizona again, like if they, by keeping the band together, they had something to sell to the those guys who were coming back for their last seasons of eligibility in regards to, like we got, you have guys, you have elder statesmen who can come back and win, right? They're going to the Big 12. Their schedule probably gets easier. I don't think it gets more difficult going into the Big 12. They might be a team that can compete for a Big 12 title and get one of those playoff spots. Whereas like Washington going into the Big 10 with the schedule they have and just the realities of what can be assembled there in the second portal window, like there's no opportunity to win anything next year. And so I think that's really the biggest thing that plays a part there.
Makes a lot of sense. All right. You want to move on to some listener questions?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Oregon Recruiting asks, question. I think Oregon fans are confident in the main six getting drafted. Bo Nix, Bucky, Troy, JPJ, Kyrie Jackson, and Brandon Dorlus. But who else should be on our radar of possibly getting drafted? Evan Williams, maybe. Any other of our defensive line? So first of all, let's start. Do you agree with him that all six of those players mentioned will be drafted? Bo, yes. Bucky?
Yep.
Yes. Troy, obviously. JPJ, for sure. Kyrie Jackson, Brandon Dorlus. Are they both drafted?
Yeah, they're both. Yeah, for sure. So I agree.
Anyone else then?
I think Evan Williams is probably the one that's got the best shot beyond that group. Anyone other than Evan Williams, whether it's Taki or Popo, to me, like those guys are dime a dozen. They're two down interior run defenders, and neither of them, like at least Popo has decent length, but he's also older and has quite the injury history. And I think his medical will ding him and it'll stop somebody from using draft capital, because really the difference between like a sixth or seventh round pick and an undrafted free agent isn't that much. But I'm sure those guys, whether it's Casey Rogers, Taki, Popo, will all get picked up in the camps. I really have a hard time seeing anybody using draft capital on them. But I could see Evan Williams. I mean, we saw Brady Breeze get drafted, for crying out loud. Like I could see Evan Williams sneaking in.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's anybody else. I can't think of anybody else. So Steven Jones, not a camp kind of guy too. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think about six, okay. Like when you consider how many guys opted to come back, six or seven would be a really strong draft class still.
Yeah, we have six last year.
I think it was six last year as well.
I think it was six last year. Six this year, maybe seven, and then next year the haul could be quite large, because like you said, all those guys that opted back in this year will be in the draft, as well as some other guys from this year's team. So yeah, it could be even higher.
I just don't assume anymore that our guys are all just going to mass exodus, because we do a really good job now of retaining guys who like are on the bubble or are mid round picks. Whereas like the high end guys, the guys that are going to go day one, early day two, it's really tough to justify them coming back, because for the most part, those guys are who they are. There's not a lot of chance for guys who have a day two skill set to come back and turn it into a day one skill set, which is where you get the extra year on your deal and you get the better signing bonus and guaranteed money. So without getting too far much further into the weeds than I already just went, it's mostly like the day three, late day two guys that you can convince to come back, and Oregon's NIL is good enough that they can do that whenever they really want somebody.
That is an excellent point. All right. Hayward Hawk asked us our next question. Excluding any 2024 newcomers, which players are we not talking about that will either be on the two deep or contributors next season? Pulling up my roster to answer this question.
Yeah,
People were not.
the guys that I think probably don't get talked about enough would be Dalen Austin. I think he's going to play a major role as the nickel, whether it's as a starter or as a rotational player. This actually kind of goes, I don't know. I know you said we had a couple roster management questions, but this is one I actually wanted to talk about. So I'm glad it came up. Is Oregon was very fortunate at both wide receiver and safety last year to get away with really limited rotations and have those limited guys not get healthy or not get hurt. Sorry. So like Steve Stevens, Tysheem Johnson, and Evan Williams played basically 100% of the snaps in meaningful time once Addison opted out. And that put us in a position where we only had three safeties, and we made it through the whole season with three. And at receiver, we've only really played four guys, and we lost Gary Bryant very briefly, but for the most part, we had all four guys all season. I think Oregon's going to have deeper rotations at those positions next year, and I think that you're also going to see more guys, more bodies above the line and contributing. So I would say Dalen Austin is going to be a beneficiary of that. He's a true freshman. He hasn't even been on campus yet, but Aaron Flowers is a guy that also comes to mind in the secondary. In terms of not getting talked about, I think everyone is assuming that this Jamari Caldwell kid is starting nose tackle. I think Amari Washington will start at nose tackle. I think a lot of people are assuming that someone older, whether it's where Hudson or Roberts, will do that. I think Amari Washington and Caldwell will be starting on the interior of the defensive line next year.
Do you think they'll both be starting?
Yeah, next to each other.
Yeah, gotcha. I was going to ask you about a defensive lineman because I don't know which one to pick, but it does feel like one of those class of 23 guys, and you mentioned Washington, would be probably someone not being talked about, right? I know there's people that are like, oh, Oregon needs to get two or three more defensive linemen out of the portal, which I just cannot disagree with.
No, that's
obviously if you can go get like a David Hicks or you know the other guy from A&M that we didn't get, sure. But like we have bodies and we have young talented bodies. Like it's like taking a JAG level player who's a senior but a replacement level player who's a senior just doesn't make any sense.
Well, to me, like the line for what you would take or not take is. Would the defensive lineman that you're going to take be one of your best two? Because if they're not going to be one of your best two, we don't have space. You're just pushing
someone to the portal at that point.
Yeah, you didn't recruit all these guys to not play them. And sometimes I think certain people in our fan base think that we did recruit these guys to not play them and to just take a massive transfer portal class every year and neglect the development of the young guys that we made commitments to, which is pretty disappointing because like you can get good players out of the portal. I'm certainly not making the argument that you can't or that we haven't because we've done very, very well in the transfer portal, but it's also a thing where there's diminishing returns on that style of roster management. And so just really, really hoping to see. I'm kind of losing myself here, Doug. Save me.
No. I'll throw a name out there. Kenan Sadiq is another one that I would mention as a. Some people are talking about him, but I think he's still a little under the radar, and I think he could. And you've talked about him in the past as well, but I'll put him out there as someone who
he's a player, and I think Jay Harris is probably like we haven't seen him play yet, but.
Yeah,
I know Locke likes to play probably two or three backs, and I think he's got a shot because he's got a different skill set than the rest of the room.
All right, move on to the next question. Dan Block asks, you guys have talked before about not knowing the true scholarship count. With NIL, it seems they can replicate a scholarship in a way. I'm wondering if there are non-tuition and housing differences between walk-ons and scholarships, i.e. does a walk-on not get the training table, tutors, etc.? This is an excellent question. I don't know the full answer to this. I know that the line has been blurred more recently in far as what benefits are available and not available between walk-ons and scholarship players. There is still a difference, though. There are benefits provided to scholarship players that walk-ons are not supposed to get. So, and there's also like non-direct benefit reasons why a player wouldn't want to just be like, oh, yeah, I'll be a walk-on, right? Like, I think it makes sense in the right circumstances for the player and for Oregon, but it's not something I expect to see. Like, we're not going to get 110 guys on the roster by putting 30, like, scholarship-level players on as walk-ons. Like, that's not going to happen anywhere, I don't think.
No, definitely not. Again, it can. I think you can use it for a handful of spots, but I again, it's you're never going to have 25 guys that you're bringing in with NIL as walk-ons. So,
all right, Connor Zins asks, please explain how Washington will be able to field a remotely competitive Big Ten level team by next fall, and how they will also add the needed depth in order to remain competitive throughout a long season.
question kind of answers itself, but it'd be just nice to listen from you too. Well, I think we did that, Connor. I think we obliged you for the last 20 minutes before this listener's question segment. And we agree.
But yeah, I don't think they do, right? Like, that's the answer. Yeah. And it's an answer that I thoroughly enjoy, right? Like, that's a feel-good answer. But I will say this, like, I don't think, I would love to be wrong. It's not like they're going to go 0-12. They're not going to just be a complete unmitigated disaster. Because they have a couple pieces.
And they have good coaching. I do think that's a good coaching staff. They'll figure it out.
And they have enough pieces offensively to figure something out. But the level of competition takes a big jump up in this conference on a week-to-week basis. And I think they're going to learn that the hard way. Like, when you play Rutgers in New Jersey, it is not like playing Cal. Like, that's a much better football team than Cal.
Totally agree. Okay, T-Rod asks, with the roster as of today, do you see the secondary being either A, somewhat improved, B, considerably improved, or D, wait, D? How did I skip D? C, vastly improved. Somewhat improved, considerably improved, or vastly improved secondary?
Vastly.
Vastly. Wow, that's a strong statement.
Well, I think especially if you're adding Jabbar, I think you've got like just incredible depth of corners that can cover. You've got, I think that there's no way that we're worse at safety, especially because I gave those guys props for playing all the snaps, but like if like Steve Stevens playing all the snaps is probably not the best thing for the program. But he's all we had. And so I just think that by just the pure volume of guys that they've brought in, you return some experience with a guy like Tysheem Johnson. You've got guys like Jaleel Florence coming back. I have guys like Dante Manning coming back, and then you're adding in what they've added in both through prep, recruiting, transfer portal. There's just too many. There's far more quality players than there was a year ago. And because of that, I think that they'll be able to find creative solutions to getting a lot of different mixtures of guys on the field situationally, which will keep us fresher. And I think ultimately end up in us playing better.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Wow, we have a lot of questions submitted, QB. We're getting more and more questions every time we do this, so I think I'm going to have to filter maybe some of these.
I like it.
But I agree. Okay. I was going to say B, considerably improved, but with the idea that it could turn into C, but I want to see it first. But I like your bold putting a stake in the ground on that
one. Well, let me justify just a tiny bit more. So to me, I look at Savage to, or Evan Williams to Savage is basically the same thing. Tysheem Johnson is going to be part of the rotation, and I liked him last year, but with between Johnson, Flowers, Kamari Terrell was hurt all year, Dalen Austin moving over into the nickel role, bringing in guys like Aaron Flowers and Kingston Lopa, and then having guys like DeCambra and Turner coming off of red shirts. I just think that there's no chance that it is as thin of a room as it was a year ago. And I think that just with the quantity that you have available to you at your fingertips, there's just no way that the interior of the secondary doesn't get a lot better.
All right. Agreed. Big Joe, Wisconsin 09, Oregon 11. Hey, he's a Wisconsin, Oregon fan, just
that.
Like you.
I love that for us.
What position group will hold us back from getting deep in the playoffs? Which one can you see helping us get over the top?
If a group is going to hold us back, it's going to be the interior defensive line. It's going to be because of youth and experience and injuries.
I was going to say safety, but I like your answer. Those were the two obvious answers. One of those two.
Yeah. And then what group will help us? I think
get over the top.
I think the edge group is going to be really good. Like, I think getting that trio of Purchase, Tuioti, and Mateo, and then returning Birch, like, that group is going to be nationally elite, in my opinion. I think those guys are all going to take big jumps as pass rushers. The young guys are going to develop physically, become more consistent run defenders. And I think it's going to give the staff a really deep and fun room to play with.
I'm going to say the offensive line. It's a pretty boring answer, but I think if we get over the top, it's because they have taken another step forward.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, protecting the quarterback or getting after him, it's one of those two.
That's right. All right, Josh Cole asks, what aspect of Dillon Gabriel's game are Duck fans most likely underrating?
I think he throws a really, really nice deep ball. But I will say, like, I don't know that he's quite as fluid of an athlete as Bo Nix was, but he is a good athlete.
Okay. Kelly Gamblin.
You have nothing
anticipate
to
anticipate any player. What?
You have not, you have nothing to add?
I don't scout players, QB, so I will take your answer.
Fair enough. All right, we roll.
I would just say, like, I guess I would say something that's a little bit less scouty and a little bit more just observational is I feel like he's a gamer, right? Like, he plays big in big moments. I just think I've seen that at times throughout his career. You know, we obviously the Red River shootout rivalry, whatever you want to call it, last year was a good example of that, right? So I kind of think that, like, clutch gene or whatever you want to call it, I think he's had aspects of that at time and shown that, right? So that might be something to notice.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
Kelly Gamblin asks, do we anticipate any player position changes from last year? I mean, I think we've obviously talked about Dalen Austin moving into nickel quite a bit. I do feel like between nickel, safety, corner, maybe. I we'll see what happens come, you know, spring ball and fall camp and see who's playing where. But, I mean, they brought in Brandon Johnson. They brought in potentially Jabbar Muhammad. They brought in Cam Alexander. They brought in Savage, right? And then they've got all these other returning players, younger players that you just mentioned in the safety room, but also some in the corner room. So it feels like there's opportunity for changes there that we may not be aware of, but I can't say anything for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the only changes that I could foresee, like, I think it really has to be second-level defenders on defense, unless it's a guy, the exception of that being, like, Johnny Bowens. Like, does he pack on more weight and move inside on the defensive line? But we didn't really see definitively what his role was a year ago, so it's tough to even say that. But I agree. I think it's in the secondary. I think Dalen Austin moving to nickel is the star position is a big one. Tysheem Johnson possibly moving back to deep safety with the addition of Brandon Johnson to that room, I think would make sense. Other than that, like, I don't see any safeties moving to linebacker, and I don't see anyone moving around from offense to defense.
No, I don't see anything like that at all. It's pretty straightforward. Okay. Carrie Mallon asks, has Oregon brought in enough help at safety yet, or is more help needed? What is the future of Austin Novosad? Will Dante Moore, that's a lot of questions. Will Dante Moore be redshirted in 24 or only, I want to talk about this one, or only if he's not needed to fill in? Do you have any status updates on Noah Whittington? Okay, right, where do you want to talk? Let's start with the first one. Yeah, have we brought in enough safety help?
I think we have.
I agree.
Unless like obviously like players like Caleb Downs, like you.
Yeah. Caleb Downs wanted to come here. Obviously you take him.
Yeah. There's always room for that quality of player. But beyond like anything crazy happening, I think we're done at safety.
What is the future for Austin Novosad? We'll see. I mean, obviously he's going to start as the third on the depth chart this year, and we'll decide, I guess he'll decide if he wants to, you know, what he wants to do beyond that. And, you know, it's I don't know. I wouldn't want to predict what I think the guy should do or will do.
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head. I mean, he's going to have an opportunity to develop. I think we know who our next two quarterbacks are going to be, but if he's willing to stick around and learn and compete, maybe he can prove me wrong, or maybe he can be the third guy.
Yeah. Will Dante Moore be redshirted in 24? Okay, I've got to get to this. I heard somebody talking about this the other day. Like whether Oregon should redshirt Dante Moore or not. Look, the idea, unless you're talking about, in my opinion, unless you're talking about offensive linemen or defensive linemen, I don't think you should go into any, in this era, we've got to redshirt this guy so we can have him here 6 years from now, or 5 years from now when he's a redshirt senior. No, like if Dante Moore is good, he's not going to be here that long anyway. And if he's not good, he's not going to be here that long anyway.
Yeah.
So, like, there's no reason to try to redshirt him to save him for, what would that be? Let's see. This would be his year two. Year three would be 2025. Year four would be 2026. We don't need to redshirt him so he can come back and play in 2027. He's not going to be here in 2027, no matter under any circumstance.
Well, it depends.
So there's no reason to redshirt him.
I don't know if I agree or not. I'm actually working through it myself right now. I'll talk through it out loud, though. So first and foremost, if you think he's a two-and-done player, like, or if you think he's a two-year starter and off to the NFL guy, which I think is a very, very, very real possibility for him, specifically in the system now that he's away from Westwood, I don't think that you'd be crazy to project that. Now, what if he's not? What if he takes a little bit longer than we hoped, or what if he gets hurt in another year? I mean, you could always apply for a medical redshirt. But there is not a non-zero chance that having that extra year of eligibility might be useful down the road. I'm not saying it will be. I don't think it's the most likely outcome, but what if he's ends up being a really good college quarterback that doesn't have like the massive NFL projectables. And so he would be someone that you could buy like a Bo Nix, like a Dylan Gabriel to play a senior year.
Let me put the question a different way. I don't disagree with that, by the way. For 2024, if your options are, we can play you in four games, mop-up duty, whatever, maybe you know, you play almost a half a game in two of these preseason contests, and then you play a quarter in two other games, and then you sit on the bench the rest of the year. Or is it better, if you're planning on him being your starter in 2025, would you rather play him in 8, 9, 10 games this year, have him get more reps, more game reps, more real reps, so that he's more prepared for 2025? Like, what do you care more about, 2025 and 2026?
You and
or
I
are, some potential future 2027?
So, like, I agree with you. And I think, like, the way I look at Dante as a talent, and, like, I think the staff agrees, and the way they look at him, like, it's really what this is get him as much playing time as you can. If you can play him in all 12 games, 13 games, 14, 15, 16 games, then do it by all means, because it's just going to make you better the following season. And really, like, I don't think you should play scared. Like, I don't think he should play. Like, you brought Dante Moore in because you think he's going to be good enough to be not just a starter, but a really good starter for you in a year. And if that's going to be the case, like, he's already proven the ability to play. It's not like he didn't. Was it always pretty at UCLA? No, but he can play. So I think that, like, I do think it's silly and a little bit wasteful to worry about a potential for 2027 when it might undermine his development for next year.
Exactly. Thank you. You said it more eloquently and less angrily than I did. So,
yeah.
Well done.
That's fair. Gotta quit being such an angry guy.
I'm not trying to be angry. I just like that. I find that question to be just laughable. Like, this idea that somebody would like debate this with like sincerity for like 15 minutes just blew my mind to the point where I got
angry. At least think about it a little bit. Like, I was thinking, like, from the perspective, because like I might not be super rational. Like, I might have a little bit of fan glasses on when I'm like, well, I think this guy is probably a guy that we'll be lucky to get a second year out of because he's going to be so good. let alone a third year, right? So,
well, the other thing too is, you know, you
as a starter,
what if he gets injured down the road? Then you redshirt him then, right? Like, I don't know.
No, I just don't
believe in saving redshirts at this in this era of college football,
especially
like,
a quarterback. To be honest with you, because it's like he's either going to be good enough to play for it's a start for 1 or 2 years for us and then go to the NFL, or he's probably not even going to be get an opportunity to start for us for a third year.
Right, and you're going to move on to somebody
else.
All right, Mike Ellickson asks, aside from Bear, is Oregon pursuing any high school recruits to sign in February? I'm only aware of Bear. I don't think there's anybody else but Bear. Matt Pries asks, will Aaron Flowers be in the safety rotation this fall? I predict yes.
I predict yes as well.
Gabe Lowenkron, all signs seem to be pointing to a Oregon-Ohio State battle for the Big Ten next year. Can you give your post downs to Ohio State assessment of that battle? It feels like Ohio State has a clear edge on defense and the Ducks have a small edge on offense. As things sit today, who do you like next October in Autzen? It's a great question.
You go first.
Okay. I do think that it's strength on strength, Oregon's offense against Ohio State's defense on that side of the ball. So I think those are going to be two high-level units, and that battle will be really fun to watch. And obviously, yeah, Downs makes that defense even better. They got a lot of guys to come back. They are really good on defense this year. So that will be a fun matchup to battle. But the more intriguing one, because I think there's a lot more unknowns, is the other side of the ball when Ohio State's on offense, right? I mean, I think obviously we have some projecting to do and to wait and see what happens with Oregon on defense, particularly on the interior defensive line and in that back end of the defense, as we've been talking about. But also Ohio State, you know, Ryan Day is not going to call plays next year. They've hired Bill O'Brien to be their play caller, which is a change for them. They seem to be shifting toward a more, you know, power running attack in their approach. Not to say they don't have like high end wide receivers who will be very dangerous and Oregon will have to account for. Also Will Howard coming over from Kansas State at the quarterback position. So I think there's questions on what the Ohio State offense looks like and how well they perform. And I think there's questions on, you know, as we talked about with Oregon's defense. So I think that matchup is one that I'm really interested to watch. And I think ultimately could decide that game.
I think it's far more likely that both of these teams end up with top 10 units on both sides of the ball than it is unlikely. And so like, yeah, there's some questions with Oregon's defense. There's some questions with Ohio State's offense, but I still think these are going to be two top 10 units on both sides of the ball. So I expect this to be like, to me, that's the biggest home game ever at Oregon. It's going to be probably a top three matchup at that point between Oregon and Ohio State, with probably two of the better teams that either of those teams have fielded recently, which is saying something. So it's going to be a hell of a matchup. I lean Ohio State.
You think Game Day and Big Noon will be there?
Yeah. I lean Ohio State kind of, because I think their defense is, probably a little bit better than ours. And I also think that they're a little bit more proven just given like who they return at certain positions. Whereas we have a little bit more projection to do still, but I think the talent is there to be just as good. But it is an Autzen. So that's going to be a hell of a football game. The thing is that Ohio State is a big question that no one's talking about in that offensive line. Like it was garbage last year, relative to what they're used to. Not garbage relative to like Washington State or Colorado. And so we'll have to see how that looks this year as well.
Yeah, I can't wait to be at this game. It's going to be incredible atmosphere, incredible game. Like all eyes everywhere in the country are going to be talking about this game and the lead up to it. It's a pickup game. I don't know. You know, I like both. it's going to be a war. And I don't think you know, someone's going to lose the game, but I don't think there's a loser, right? Because both these teams are still going to be right there at the end of the year, you know, for battling for all the marbles. And so,
yeah,
it'll be fun to watch. All right, Lloyd Berg asks, what are some things that Dylan Gabriel does better or worse than Bo Nix? What could be some differences we see in the passing game due to those differences?
Well, I think Gabriel's a better deep ball thrower than Nix naturally. Nix has a bigger arm, so it sounds kind of counterintuitive, but I think his touch and timing is much better on deep ball. I'm speaking of Gabriel. Nix is probably the hardest quarterback to sack, not named Caleb Williams, that I've seen in a while. And I want to see how Gabriel is avoiding pressure and making those micro adjustments within the pocket the way that Nix does.
Yeah, Nix is so, like, I think people undervalued how accurate Nix was. And I don't just mean the percentage of completions, right? I mean the ball placement right in the perfect spot for that his receivers are catching it in stride and immediately getting into, you know, turning upfield and getting yak, right? Like, very seldom did receivers have to adjust, especially on the short to medium underneath stuff, right? Have to adjust at all to his throws. It was like just so on the money, perfectly in stride. Like, that is, I think when you go back a few years and watch Anthony Brown when quarterbacking Oregon, right? And not to pick on Anthony, but that's the stark difference, right? Because even on those same types of throws, the balls are behind, the balls are high, the balls are low. Like, guys have to stop, guys have to turn around, guys have to adjust. And all of a sudden now, that three-yard throw is a three-yard gain instead of a 7 or 8 or 10 or 15-yard gain just because of the accuracy of that ball placement, right? And Nix is elite at that.
Yeah, and honestly, Gabriel's incredibly accurate. Like, I know you haven't watched nearly as much Gabriel as I have, but, like, that's his thing. Like, it's ball placement, touch, and accuracy and timing. And I think that Gabriel fits the system and what we're going to ask him to do really, really well. The question is, can he execute the system at the level that Bo did? Because Bo had complete mastery down the stretch last year. And that's
a lot of the pre-snap stuff.
Yeah, both pre-snap and post-snap. So that'll be the piece, is like, can Gabriel match that level of preparation and in the system understanding and system mastery? That'll be tough to do and without having two full years here, but I think he's got a shot, so we'll see.
Yeah, it does seem like about as seamless of a transition as you could hope for. Like, the games are similar in so many ways, and Gabriel fits the system so well, so it really couldn't, it would have been hard to find a more ideal plug and play replacement. All right, next question. With our move to the Big Ten, who do you think could be the new, quote, Ducks in the Desert, quote, team, a school where it seems that we can never find success on the road against them?
Iowa.
And, you know, not including like Ohio State, Michigan, Penn State, right? But like more of a, like, a team that's below us, but that we always lose to on the road.
Iowa.
That was one of the ones that popped out of my head immediately too.
I watched so many good teams get smoked in Iowa by a team that can't even score a touchdown. It's the wildest thing you've ever seen.
Iowa's kind of the obvious choice. I noodled around with Wisconsin, although they're a pretty high low. Maybe they're too good of a team to label that way. Nebraska maybe might be another one. I don't know. Those Midwestern teams, they all kind of seem the same to me.
I mean, yeah, I think like when I think of teams that are annoying, I actually think Maryland has the capability of being pretty annoying. I think Iowa, Wisconsin, Nebraska,
it's a long trip too,
are they're the meaty upper middle of the league now. And those are going to be tough places to go play. Those are great environments.
All right. We kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, so I'm going to think I know your answer on this, but Big Ten Duck asks, over under 9.5 on Ducks you think will get drafted in the 2025 draft, so a year down the road. If everyone declares and performs as expected, these are locks, in my opinion. Connerly, Cornelius, Jordan James, Evan Stewart, Tez Birch, Caldwell, Bosa, plus guys like Gabriel Ferg, Jacob Savage, Cam, who all can get into. So I think I would take the under because I think, to your point, QB, not all these guys will declare and leave.
Yeah, the guys, again, we'll be able to get some of those guys back who have later round grades. I also think people are very premature with the Connerly stuff. I don't think it's a guarantee.
Yeah, I'm not sure he's a three-year player.
I'm not sure he's a three-year player either, because he played really well this year, but like, to be an NFL guy, he needs to get a lot stronger, and I don't know that it's a one-off season fix. especially if he wants to get drafted where I know he wants to get drafted, and frankly, where his athletic talent will allow him to once he gets his strength built up. But I wouldn't be surprised. Like, we'll just see. It's one of those things we're just gonna have to see when we see it, right? Like, well, how much stronger is Connor Lee functionally next fall? We'll find out. But again, it would not surprise me one bit if he ended up being a four-year player.
I totally agree. And if he looks across the line and he looks at like a Johnny, right, who could have went to the draft this year, came back for one more year, and then let's see what happens with him this year, right? Do you see a noticeable step forward with him? Does his draft grade come back, you know, much better, you know, next summer than it would have this or next spring than it did this spring? And that might be the model to follow, right? And obviously, that's great for Oregon, and Connerly is an NFL player, absolutely. So, if we can keep him one more year, it's great for us, and doesn't mean I want him not to find the most success for himself that he can, obviously.
Yeah, I agree. I'm excited, though. I would say, like, I would think that next year will be the biggest group we've ever had drafted.
I think so, too. And I think at this point, you know, barring any changes – you know, into the program, right? I think we're on, like, we're now going to be dialed into where it's like six plus every year, right? So you're not going to have these, like, oh, we have this big year of draftees and then we drop back to one or two and then another surge comes along. No, it's going to be like, it's six this year, it's seven next year, it's nine that year, then it's six again, then it's eight. Like, we're going to be living in that realm, I think, year after year after year, because that's the kind of talent that's been built up now in the program.
I could not agree more. I think that's exactly the truth. I think that we're going to be at a pace where we're putting guys in, and I think our big years are going to be bigger than what we're used to by probably 2x as well. Because like a big year historically has been about six guys, and I think that we're going to be in a position as a roster where we might have some years where we get 10, 11, 12 guys drafted.
Absolutely. All right, we got five more questions, QB. Michigan Duck. This is another good question I like. Each of you name one returning player, one transfer player, and one true freshman that is poised to have a breakout year. No duplicates. Man, it's tough parameters.
All right, you want
to? All right, returning player that's poised to have a breakout year. You go first.
Dylan Austin. It's my guy. I got to stick with him.
Sure. That's your guy. I'm going to go with, like, what? Again, we have to define breakout. If I pick Mateo, is he eligible, or did he already have a breakout year?
I think that there is certainly a lot of room. Like, those guys were just scratching the surface. So I think you could pick any of those guys. I almost picked Blake Purchase.
That was another one I liked.
But also, like, the interior guys, like Washington and Green are going to be really interesting to watch. That's a tough one. That class that we signed a year ago was so good. Like Poncho, how much of a drop off is it going to be from JPJ to him?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be that much. And that's not a knock on JPJ, right? I mean, there'll definitely be a drop off in some ways, but I'm really impressed by him for sure. I'll go with Sadiq again as well. I think that's another guy that's going to have a breakout year, or a guy who played very minimally last year. Okay, how about transfer? Dylan Gabriel is the easy one. It's almost cheating.
Yeah. I'm trying to think.
Devin Stewart?
Jamari Caldwell.
Yeah.
I think he'll be a national name by the end of the season.
Love it. Love it. Okay. And then true freshman, I'm going to go Flowers before you get it.
All right, you're going Flowers.
We got Elijah Rushing, Breland, Iffy, McClellan, Jericho.
I'm debating between Breland and I'm trying to figure out which linebacker I think it is. It's gonna pop.
Which linebacker? I think I go with Dylan if it's a linebacker.
Yeah, I think it's going to be Dylan Williams too, but there were some things I saw from Kamari at the Army game that have me wondering.
I know. I'm excited. I hope they both do. How about that?
Yeah.
All right, I think we gave some bonus ones there. Okay, Jeremy Bowman. Do we have a running back currently on the roster that can be a featured back in 2025 if James and Whittington both leave after the season? Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think they're both going to leave after the season, but if they do,
we'll see what Jay Harris looks like. He's got
multiple years,
and we'll find out about Dewan Riggs and some of those other guys. But yeah, running back's going to be a really interesting position to watch in the transition from next year to the following.
How many more questions do we have, Doug?
We got three more.
All right, let's power through
these. A little fast. Yes. Chad Medeiros. Right now, who makes up the two deep at nose tackle? I think you kind of answered this earlier.
It's Washington Roberts.
All right. That one guy, do you think what Washington went through over the last month is the worst since the USC sanctions? They lost a national title, lost their head coach, and then lost their roster.
Yeah, I would say so, but I think what LSU, what happened to LSU after 19 was pretty brutal, because like they lost Joe Brady, they lost Dave Aranda, they lost so many NFL players, and it was just Orgeron staring at a room of emptiness. And so with no Joe Burrow.
But I would say that's more like internal incompetence versus like things that kind of happened to you. At least the first domino was a little bit outside of your control, right?
Yeah.
A little different.
I guess so.
But that's a good one too. The implosion of Washington, they went from like playing in a national title game to having no coach and a roster exodus like in less than a week. Like that, certainly that time lapse from that highest of highs to, oh my God, we might win four games next year, and all happening within the span of 7 days is pretty unprecedented and quite delightful.
I thoroughly enjoyed every second of it. 10 out of 10 would recommend.
Yeah. And 10 out of 10. Yes. And the last and final question from Key.
Oh no.
Will QB admit that Key is always right?
There's no way this guy did. Absolutely. He's wrong about most things, but at least he's reasonable enough to admit it in private.
How to end on that one?
Well played.
But yes, he's not right about Jabbar.
No, Key is very wrong about Jabbar and Dylan Gabriel. But he's usually pretty
good.
He's a heightist. Yeah, he very much does not like people under 6 foot. But it's fine.
All right, Andrew, that wraps up this episode. We will be back next Monday. That's me knocking on wood with Justin, assuming we get our technical difficulties ironed out. I know we will, and we'll be back, and it's been a great episode. Thanks for chatting with me.
Agreed. No problem, Doug. Hope you have a great rest of your week, and we will talk on Monday.
All right. Follow him at QB11SD. I'm at DouglasTS, and, of course, the pod is at QB11Show. Thank you for listening. We will talk to you soon.